Esto es únicamente una prueba. 1, 2, 1, 2.
In Montreal.
CKUT. All the rhythms, all the music, all the time.
90.3 FM.
Okay, I gotta let you go. I have to get my Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
This is Lukey D.
Real food you want. Come to Mango Bay every day.
Real food.
Mango Bay Restaurant, located in the heart of downtown Montreal, 1236 Mackay Street, Suite 201. For reservations, please call 514-875-7082 or visit mangobay.ca. Real food.
Let's get together and feel all
right. The X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-X-
Space and time.
So my name is Liz. I'm a journalist based in New York. I write about music and culture and more recently the intersection of music and technology and streaming platforms and sort of trying to put streaming platforms in a greater cultural context, speaking with independent artists and independent record labels about the way that the sort of ecosystem of independent music has been affected by these new technologies.
So I am a big but recent fan of your work. A friend of mine sent me your articles about Spotify and their use of algorithms recently, and I just found them super fascinating. And I wonder what it was that sparked your interest in Spotify and this kind of algorithmic consumption of music.
Yeah, so I've always been interested in the sort of independent underground DIY music communities. And, you know, I've always like seen the independent and like self-made music world in its various forms as, you know, really a place where the most interesting music was being made, and also sort of like a powerful way of people taking things into their own hands and sort of like, you know, rejecting the mainstream status quo of music, which is such an obvious sentiment, but I think that it's like something to keep in mind and when navigating these new platforms, because there has always been sort of like this strong pushback or this strong alternative to what the mainstream way of consuming and gathering around music is. So I first became interested in Spotify because I was interested in the correlation between Spotify and the major record companies. Like, I knew that major labels had invested money in Spotify and that there were some sort of partnerships going on, but I was really interested in learning about the major label influence on playlists. So that was kind of my entry point. I started researching that, and I kind of thought that the most interesting sort of thing to know about Spotify would be, you know, the way that major labels are influencing the platform influencing playlists. So I wrote this article. I started working on it in 2016, and it came out in 2017, called The Secret Lives of Playlists, which mostly was focused on researching these companies called Filter, Digster, and Topsify, which are the major labels' playlisting brands that have playlists all over Spotify. And I interviewed a lot of people for that article and learned about sort of like the direct relationship that the major labels have with Spotify and the challenges that independent artists and independent labels are up against. But it also, you know, I feel like that article really got me thinking about some other ways that streaming platforms are influencing and impacting music culture and just sort of the way that people relate with music now. And I realized that, you know, those Filter, Digster, and Topsify playlists were really just the tip of the iceberg or skimming the surface of like all there is to unpack about the way that these platforms are changing our relationship to music.
And so you, through this, have uncovered and kind of articulated so many ways that Spotify's playlists seem to encourage this docile, disengaged, and kind of unchallenged listener. Can you maybe speak a little bit to your research process? Like, how much time did you spend listening to playlists, or who did you talk to?
Yeah, so for most of the articles, I feel like something that I'd like to prioritize is speaking with artists and speaking with people who run independent record labels, because there's a lot of coverage of streaming platforms, and there's a lot of thinking and writing about the way that the music industry is changing, but it seems like the voice that's often left out is artists themselves, and especially independent artists. So I feel like from my perspective, I'm way more interested in speaking with people about their actual experiences and speaking with artists about their actual experiences. So, you know, it's been pretty interesting. Like, once I released the first of these articles, I kind of feel like I'm involved in a music community myself as someone who, you know, used to work at a venue and plays music and book shows and goes through a lot of shows. So a lot of the initial sort of research process for me, I feel like, is just sort of talking to people and hearing people's perspectives on how these platforms are affecting them, and then, you know, kind of following the threads of what seems interesting, and then going and doing, you know, formal interviews with people who are willing to speak. It's kind of hard, because at first I felt like a lot of people, you know, rightfully so, a lot of people who work at labels are hesitant to go on the record, because it, and a lot of artists are as well, because they don't want to risk their chances of not getting supported by these platforms in terms of the curated playlists. And, you know, these platforms are a really big part of how artists of all sizes roll out their album campaigns and promote their singles and stuff like that. Yeah, but it's different for every piece. For the first few pieces that I wrote, it was, you know, a lot of like interviewing. And then most recently, I wrote this piece called Discover Weekly that was about sexism on Spotify and the way the biggest playlists on the platform are male-dominated, and kind of the way algorithms uphold that gender bias. And for that piece, that was mostly just through firsthand research. I made a new Spotify account, and I only listened to the most popular playlists on Spotify for a month. And then I looked at the gender bias on those popular playlists I was listening to. And then I looked at the gender bias on the algorithmic suggestions every week. And I did that research myself. And so that was an interesting experiment.
No kidding. Did anything really surprise you in doing this work?
Discover Weekly article, you mean?
Yes.
Actually really surprised in general. One of the reasons why I started doing that research is because there is this conference called Pop Conference that happens every April in Seattle, and this year the theme was gender, and I knew I wanted to submit something having to do with Spotify and gender, and was looking at the playlist and was actually like really shocked to see how staggeringly male-dominated the most popular playlists on Spotify were, especially because in other areas or other areas of their, you know, curated playlist browse page, there are these playlists like Feminist Friday and Women of Pop and Women of Rock and all of these sort of like attempts at branding Spotify as this like woke feminist platform. So I was at first honestly really shocked to see how male-dominated the biggest playlists on the platform were. Like, I listened to the playlist I looked at were today's top hits, which is the biggest pop playlist on the platform, and I looked at Rap Caviar, Rock This, Hot Country, Viva Latino, and New Music Friday, which are, you know, amongst the most followed playlists. They all have millions of followers. I think today's top hits has like 20 million followers, and the rest of them have between, you know, 3 and 10 million followers from what I remember. The ones that were the most balanced in terms of gender bias were like 75% male artists, and then some of them were, you know, between 90 and 92% male artists. So, I was pretty shocked.
Wow. Like that, yeah, that is so shocking. So you talk about this, the Smirnoff equalizer. So this is kind of this algorithm that's meant to look at your listening history and then suggest playlists so that you can somehow have a more equal gender balance in your mm-hmm. music consumption?
Oh, yeah. So that was while I was doing the research on this, or while I was in the process of writing this article. I was already working on the piece when this happened. It was surrounding International Women's Day. Spotify partnered with Smirnoff to create this sort of branded algorithmic, I think I called it a woke branded algorithmic partnership or something, where, you know, you would log into it and it's presented by Smirnoff, and you would log in with your Spotify info and they'd look at your listening history and they would, based on your percentage of women versus men artists, they would tell you like what percentage you were listening to of each and then give you an algorithmically created playlist that would balance the gender ratio or something. Yeah, actually, when I was listening to Spotify's top playlist throughout that month and I logged in, it actually told me that I was listening to 100% male artists, which I thought was, like, really funny.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so, yeah, despite the fact that the top Spotify playlists are mostly male-dominated, this algorithm it's kind of putting the onus back on the listener, right? Like being like, oh, like your listening habits are actually unequal. Like here, we'll help you change this. So how does this?
Totally. That's a great point.
Which is like, okay, we can fix this with an algorithm essentially. Mm-hmm. Whereas what you're arguing is kind of that the algorithms themselves or the way that the platform is designed, it upholds this kind of male-centric status quo.
Mm-hmm. And because Spotify has curated playlists and they have algorithmic playlists, and the curated playlists are the ones that are most visible on the homepage when you log in. So if there's a new Spotify user that makes an account and maybe doesn't exactly know what to listen to, like the first things that they see that Spotify tells them to listen to are these like big curated playlists, and those are the ones that I found to be extremely male dominated. So if that's what you're listening to, and then you are looking to the algorithmic suggestions for more recommendations, it's just going to produce like more of the same, basically, like what you were already listening to. And if what you were already listening to is Spotify's sexist playlist, then you're going to get like more male dominated recommendations. It's basically like this big echo chamber effect.
Right.
Yeah. But something that I talk about in the article that was like really startling to me is that when they released the press release with the Smirnoff Equalizer earlier this year, like the press release itself said, you know, at the end of 2017, Spotify's 10 most streamed tracks were all by men artists, like not a single woman artist on their top 10 most streamed tracks on Spotify in 2017. And at the end of 2017, and there was an article in Billboard talking about how also on the pop charts, you know, it was the first time since, I think, 1983 or 1984 that the top 10 artists at the end of 2017 in Billboard were, like, there were no women artists. And I guess, like, the big question of the, one of the big questions that I was really trying to think about in the article is, like, Spotify reflecting the male-centric status quo, or is, like, the way that the echo chamber affects Spotify that sort of services this least common denominator, like, flattening of music, you know, pushing us back to, like, a more masculine and pop music culture, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, totally. Like, is the problem a bias in the listener, or is the problem a bias in the technology and the platform? And
exactly, yeah.
I mean, have you answered this question for yourself through doing this research at all, or?
I think that, you know, for me, like, the piece is more about kind of, like, opening up the question and then showing, like, the research at hand, which is showing that, you know, if the platform is pushing a male-dominated, male-dominated playlist at every turn, then, like, the algorithms are going to kind of, like, uphold that status quo. And it is an interesting question because I'm like, if we already live in, like, a music culture that is so male-dominated, does reproducing that bias through algorithms make it worse? And I think the answer is yes, but I guess some people would probably argue that it's just kind of, like, upholding what already exists. But I think that that in itself is part of the problem.
Totally.
So, yeah, that's, like, one way of thinking about it. But it is, like, a kind of an ongoing question that I feel like I'd love to, like, hear more people's perspectives on. It's, like, what exactly about this technology is inherently facilitating a male-dominated music culture. And, you know, when I presented this at a conference, someone in the audience asked that. I thought it was a really good question, but I think it's, like, one that, to me, like, I haven't exactly come to, like, an answer about.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, I think it's so fascinating as we kind of use these algorithms more and more in our daily lives. It's like, once you've identified a bias in an algorithm, like, you can remove that. But with humans, it's like, we can identify a bias, but if other people are kind of reluctant to acknowledge that we live in a male-centric culture, then it's hard to start to remove that bias, right? And then I wonder if there is kind of opportunity or possibility for algorithms in a kind of queer culture that operates but beyond these binaries. Like, can't imagine that this Smirnoff equalizer is taking into account, like, potential gender variation or non-binary folks, or if it's kind of just male, female, and the idea that algorithms are inherently kind of binary and obviously based in quantifiable data. So I wonder if there's any opportunity to kind of use algorithms in a way that operates kind of beyond binaries, or that would focus a little bit more on equity rather than just numeric equality.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there's probably an argument to be made that, you know, if the algorithm is serving a platform that inherently has the interests of, you know, queer culture and non-binary artists in mind, that it could produce, like, recommendations for artists of all different types of identities. But personally, like, I think that if you're a person who's trying to advocate against reductive ways of thinking and trying to advocate against, like, reductive ways of thinking about identity and representation, like, I don't think that, like, an algorithm is ever going to be a way to, like, facilitate that kind of discovery of, like, a non-binary culture. And I don't just mean in terms of, like, artists who identify as non-binary, but a world where we're not just kind of reducing people down to some, like, easily identifiable qualities that can be picked up by, like, algorithms, if that makes sense.
Totally, right? Like, the whole idea is just is based on being able to fit things into categories and reducing things.
Exactly. So
maybe not a useful tool.
But I also think that there's probably people who have like arguments against that, and I would definitely like be interested in hearing them.
Since reading your work, I've kind of become more aware of the ways that kind of, groups of humans can often make decisions based on these same kind of principles used by the algorithm. So continuing to just circulate what is already popular or relying on like the most easily or readily available information in making decisions. So I wonder if your inquiry into algorithms has given you a bit of a different perspective on culture in general in the digital age.
I definitely think so. I think that like something that has been really interesting about writing about this topic is that, you know, like the way that platform monopolies and algorithmic discovery tools, algorithmic news feeds or whatever, like, are impacting music culture, to me is really just like a microcosm of the way that all different types of platforms are affecting our entire world and the way that people relate to each other and the way that it's affecting culture and expression and the way people come together, the way community is formed and stuff. So yeah, it's been really interesting kind of like looking at that through the lens of music. I hope that for music fans, thinking about the way that music is being affected by algorithms can be a lens into thinking about the way that the whole world is being affected by platforms and algorithms right now, and to kind of like, you know, start to think critically about it and pick it apart, or at least be interested in learning and like reading more and understanding these platforms that are increasingly shaping basically everything about our lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is something that I observed in music, is that there are a lot of people who have said, you know, oh, I always like kind of like felt like there was something like off or wrong about these platforms, but I didn't have like a vocabulary to like articulate it. And you know, people who feel like now they're starting to have more of words to put to feelings that they had. And I think that's a dynamic that like playing out across culture right now, is people having these inherent feelings about the way that things like, you know, Facebook and Instagram are affecting them, but maybe don't have the words to articulate what feels wrong or off. And I think we're like more and more like people are starting to like have those words, which is powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what kind of struck me about your work so much, as I'm like, these things I think about, but I don't know how to articulate them in this way. And I think also because we're implicated, right? Like as listeners, as people who, you know, use the internet and go on social media, like we are implicated in the problem. So it's kind of even harder to be able to analyze it in any kind of meaningful way.
Mm.
Or just seems even more consuming when you're kind of inside of it.
Yeah, totally. And it's like part of your life. And yeah, something that you like actually have to like reckon with. And it, you know, there is like all of this sort of responsibility that is like unfairly put on the like individuals and where we fit into these ecosystems and stuff. And I think that obviously a lot of you know, responsibility for the way that these platforms are shaping our lives should be put on the corporations that in advertising us, like, you know, what's essentially advertising platforms that, you know, they you know, run these platforms. But at the same time, I think people need to be conscious of like what feels like good in their lives and what doesn't. You know, even if something is like this, like really all-consuming aspect of culture, like if it's on a day-to-day basis making you feel bad about the way that you relate to something that's so important to you, such as music, then you can just stop using it. But I understand that it's also really challenging for independent artists who are trying to make a living, and maybe that small check that you're getting like every few months from Spotify, like it's really important part of how you script together your living, and you can't say no to it. Like, or you're someone who doesn't have the time and energy to be involved in a music community the way other people do, and like having algorithmic recommendations are a part of how you find out about music. And, you know, maybe you know that it's like doesn't feel as good as getting recommendations from humans, but you don't know like where else to turn at this point or something, because the convenience of it has just conditioned you into this being how you find out about music. Like, I know it's like everyone's situation is different. Yeah, I think it's just like important for people to be conscious of the way that platforms are affecting their relationships with things that are important to them, and just sort of like being critical of it and intentional about, you know, making decisions that feel good to them.
Totally.
You know, these platforms are very much about like prescribing like one way that everything should exist to like listeners and fans and artists and labels alike. But it's important for people to remember that like they still have agency and choice in this world, and that you can like look at the bigger picture of things and pick what feels good to you and what works for you. And if it's streaming services like aren't that, like you can like reject them and not use them, or you know, maybe it's some combination of all of these different things, or like experimenting with them. So yeah, like just being conscious, and also like, you know, something about these platforms, like music stream platforms and platforms in general, is that they try to just make everything as convenient as possible. And I think like not sort of like feeding into that like convenience culture for you, like the process of finding it and accessing it and listening to it, like doesn't need to be like the most convenient thing in the world. Like new platforms pop up and they're like maybe not as seamless and convenient as some of these like more mainstream platforms, keeping that in mind, that people making things on their own terms is like never going to be as convenient and easy as Spotify and Apple Music.
Okay, so we're going to wrap things up. Where can our listeners find more of your work? Like you on Twitter or publications that you often will write for?
Yeah, a couple of my articles so far have been published by The Baffler, but probably the easiest way to keep up with them is, yeah, I'm on Twitter, at Liz Pelly. And I also have recently started a newsletter that's linked on my website. So, yeah, probably signing up for that newsletter would be the easiest way to keep up to date with all of these pieces.
Awesome. I still love newsletter culture. That's my favorite way.
It's okay. Check. Yeah. Yeah.